Okay, so the mic isn't working right at the moment. We'll see if it will work after we get some batteries up here. In the meantime, just a reminder, we have an exam here at 8 o'clock Thursday morning, and then we'll have class scheduled as normal. today, I'll have a Q&A session at 4:30 in Bausch & Lomb 106, which is at the base of the stairs. Hi. Which is at the base of the stairs on this side of Bausch & Lomb. The spirit of that is I'll try to answer any questions you have, basically, but I wouldn't think of it as a review session in a sense. I will try to answer as elaborately as I can anything that you ask, but you basically have to lead it. My philosophy in that is usually at this point I've made up the exam. I haven't gone through it myself carefully, so it might still change. But I find that once I've made out the exam, if I'm leading a review session, it's too tempting to lead you to or away from things, which in one way or another really doesn't quite work. But if you ask, I'll be as expansive as I can be in a reasonable way. So, any rate, so we'll have that at 4:30 today. Yeah, it wasn't happy. Bad. Normally, if I have batteries in there, it does something more than that.
It's not the mute.
All right. Well, thanks. I know this. Okay. So last time. Anyway. So any questions about the exam? Q&A session. Yes. No. I'll try to do that later today. I've made it out, but I need to go through the exam myself and make out the solution set and then decide, yes, this is the exam, and then modify this formula sheet as needed. But I'll try to do that today. Anything else? Yeah?
Is it 3x5 for a note card?
3x5 note card, anything you want written on it. Prayers, formulas. Yep.
What does the exam cover through roughly?
I stop before capacitance. So everything up to that. I now forget. I think I sent an email out that's got the specific workshops and problem sets. So, okay, thanks. I think it's through workshop 3 and problem set 4, if I'm not mistaken. Yes? No, I cannot possibly do that. Don't mean to be flippant or a pain in saying that, but it actually violates the spirit of what workshops are all about. If you want practice to do some problems and you want solutions, that's what I do with the problem sets. The whole purpose of the workshop is really very different, which is it is for you to go there and work together to figure things out and then work together to figure out if you really did figure things out. And if I put solutions out there, it sort of short circuits all that. And I work with my TAs to try to make sure they understand the problems, which is the other reason some people put solutions out. So it's more of a philosophical thing. So if you have a particular question about a workshop problem, then you can come talk to me or talk to a TA or talk to friends who were in workshop. So anything else? Okay. So last time we were talked about the amount of energy it takes to actually charge a capacitor. So you put it across a potential and you move charge over, and we calculated how much energy that takes, and it turns out to be 1/2 C times V squared, where V is the potential across it. C, in this case, is not the other 10 things that we label C, but capacitance. Since Q is equal to CV, there are basically three forms of this that you might use in different problems, depending on what is known in the problem. And so you'll note that in these three forms, one of the variables, CV or Q, happens to be missing. So you might find one of these forms convenient in a problem when another is not. Then we took a basic parallel plate capacitor, or charged parallel plates, where the geometry of the electric field is very well known. Now we have information about how much energy is there, and the energy basically is stored in the electric field itself. And realizing that, we could take the amount of energy and divide it by the volume of the field, which is nice and uniform, so it's a very straightforward calculation. And we found that the energy density that is in the electric field goes as epsilon naught over 2 times the magnitude of the electric field squared. And although we chose a very particular geometry where this was a calculation that was practical, this is a general result. And so I think that's very powerful, because remember, we pulled the electric field sort of out of thin air and started playing pretend with it, and it turns out that it's a very useful thing. And here's another example of where the seeming reality of this field starts to become apparent. Once you have this result, then it means you can, if you have any sort of physical situation where you can calculate the electric field, you can also calculate the energy stored in that system. So you can have some complicated... That's okay. Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. Thank you very much. What was the problem?
Just adjust it. It's on the clip-on one, so you can just move the clip-on volume up and down. It's under more mics.
Ah, okay.
So, sorry, that took a little while.
No, thanks. I've never seen that one. All right. Very exciting. Another control panel in my life. All right, is this working? Not so much yet. Is it working now? It's beginning to work. Okay. All right, so, whenever I start talking about the energy density in the electric field, I always get that big jolt of adrenaline. It's not quite fireworks. It's a little duller than that, but it's still pretty exciting. I'm hoping that some of you felt it too. So you have some complicated geometry. If you're able to analyze the electric field within that system, then you can also calculate the energy stored in the system, which you can get by integrating the energy density over the volume of whatever the thing is that you're looking at. You okay with that? All right. So we'll certainly be coming back to the energy density stored in the electric field from time to time. Then we actually shifted gears and looked at the electric field in materials. And there are lots of little code words that you have to pick up. You don't talk about electric fields in materials. You usually say electric fields and dielectrics, or it's a study of dielectrics, where this basically just means non-conductor. And then we talk about linear dielectrics, and that has a very particular meaning, which is actually quite important. It's not so important for you right now, but if you move on in physics, you'll find this is very important. You will learn to love linear dielectrics, because non-linear dielectrics are an enormous pain to deal with. But the idea with a linear dielectric is if you have some material in an electric field, and again, often you'll see this in a parallel plate situation, because the electric field, external electric field, is known and understood. So the external electric field, whatever it is, we'll just call it E0, penetrates into the substance. But when it does, you will have microscopically little dipoles, either natural inherent dipoles in the material. There'll be a torque on them, and they'll align slightly with the electric field, or I guess against. So for example, if the electric field is coming from left to right here, the negative charges will tend to align more toward the left and positive toward the right, because that'll be the torque that you would have on such an inherent dipole. Or you could have a natural nonpolar substance which actually gets a dipole induced, which is oriented in the same direction. It doesn't actually matter, but in the end, what happens is that the electric field in this material is slightly weakened because of the field from these induced dipoles inside the material. That weakening is linear in the strength of the external field, which is what you mean when you say it's a linear dielectric. Not only linear in terms of magnitude, but linear in direction. The electric field direction is not changed, but it is weakened in that direction in a linear fashion proportional to the external field. Life is hard for you in the future if you go in physics, because the internal weakening does not necessarily have to be along the lines of the field, and it doesn't have to be linearly proportional. So all of that complicates the math when you're dealing with some materials. But there are lots of materials out there that are very nice linear dielectrics, enough so that for the vast majority of what you do, this is really all you have to think about. And in fact, it's the starting place. If you're in the lab and you're wanting to fret over something, I would always start thinking in terms of linear dielectrics. If you're dealing with something that has a crystalline structure or whatever, life might be more complicated. But fluids are pretty much always going to be linear dielectrics. Okay, so you have to weaken the electric field, the external electric field, by some constant, and that constant depends on the material itself. Some materials will weaken it more than others. So here's a linear relationship. This constant is called the dielectric constant. It is always greater than one. That's the statement that we're weakening the external field inside the material. It is material dependent, but of course it's also too simple to just have this one constant. So very often we call epsilon the permittivity, which is 1 over k, or k times epsilon naught is sometimes called the permittivity. Okay, and you'll see tables of either permittivity or dielectric constants. The information is equivalent, basically, so you'll have to just know how to go back and forth. You okay with that? All right. So I want to shift gears again. And start new topics. This one basically will be current and resistance. So what I'd like to do is to imagine that we have a conductor hooked up across a battery. But I'm going to blow up the cross section of the conductor a bit, so it looks like so. And of course we put a potential across this thing. Because this side you can think of as having excess positive charge, electrons in the lattice will be attracted in that direction. So you might expect to see electrons move, okay? And in fact, they will, and we can call this the current, okay? Now, microscopically, generally what happens is that within the atoms, the nuclei are sort of fixed in the lattice structure of the metal or whatever, and the electrons literally are physically moving a little bit, okay? Not all of them. Some of them in certain shell structures are free to move. That's what makes it a conductor. And you can imagine measuring that by looking at the number of the amount of charge that passes through some cross-sectional region of this thing. And that is what we define as the instantaneous current. There are some gotchas in all this. One is, and you can blame Ben Franklin for this one, One is that physically the electrons are doing the moving. So I don't know about you, but mentally that's sort of the picture I always have. The problem is that we have to define a direction of positive current flow, okay? And it was defined in a day before we had any idea about the actual existence of electrons and atoms, well, at least the atomic structure that we currently know about. And so there was a 50-50 chance to define the direction of current flow to be correct based on the physical world, and they got it wrong. So what happens is that although in your mind you think of the electrons as moving this way, in fact, the definition, the defined direction of positive current flow is the direction that a positive charge would flow. So it is opposite the direction of the electrons going. So we're just sort of stuck with that, and you'll fight this your whole life. So I'm sorry about that, but as I say, just get a $100 bill and spit on it. So, that's about all we're going to say about the actual molecular structure, more or less, of what is going on in the metal for the most part. Just assume in a conductor that the charge is free to move, and then you know, how you think about it depends a little bit on the exact phrasing of the problem. But for the most part, think of it as a reservoir of positive charge that's free to move, and it moves in the direction of positive current flow. Okay, it's awful, but that's the way it is. Okay, now the problem is life is not necessarily so simple, because the charge will not necessarily flow so freely. So I have an analogy that I tend to use here. You can imagine that that you're walking out of the front of Rush Rees, and it's been a long, hard day of studying, and you look out across the quad and you see the love of your life all the way over there, okay? And so what do? Well, you know, it's like in the movies, so you run at each other and you embrace, and life is good, okay? So this is a happy vision. All right. And so I like to think of the electrons in this business are sort of looking for love. Okay, they want to go through this lattice happily and find love. Okay, the problem is that a lattice of a conductor is not so much like this nice empty quad. It's a little bit more like you come out of Rush Rees and graduation is happening on the quad, and it just stopped, and everybody's milling around, and you see way over there your loved one, and you try running at each other to hug, okay? And it's not so simple, because now you keep running into people, right? So it takes you a while to get there, and you're really pretty wiped out because you've been having to shove people out of the way, and you've been knocked around, and so life is really hard, okay? And, you know, if it were just a class change time, life might be easier. But if it's graduation, life is really hard. So this is sort of what the electrons looking for love run into. They can't just go like this. They sort of get knocked around. They keep hitting elements in the lattice structure. And when they do, they will actually lose a little bit of energy. And this energy basically takes the form of thermal agitation of the lattice. So it actually heats up the material, okay? And so we call this energy loss resistance. So we say that resistance, there's an A here. I like to think of it as it impedes the electrons looking for love. Now you may think I'm a crazy idiot, But you'll never forget that now. Okay. So and this is material dependent. And okay, so yikes, what did I do? Okay. All right, so what happens is that the current we define as dq over dt for any cross-sectional piece of this thing, and it is in units. Obviously, change in charge over change in time, it's going to be in coulombs per second. But because coulombs per second is something that now we're happy with, we want to redefine this, and we will call this the ampere, named after some dude named Ampere. So I'll show you some picture of him at some point. So I is dq over dt. As you might imagine, the degree to which there is a force on this electric charge to move in this conductor is going to depend on the strength of the electric field sort of in that conductor. Okay, did he actually say that? Electric field in a conductor? Well, what do you think's moving this charge? Now, I know I tell you there are no electric fields in conductors. I lied. A little. Just a little lie. In a static situation, you don't have that. But this isn't static anymore. We're sort of now shifting gears into something that's rather non-static. When you put a conductor across a battery, it will have a field in it that will cause electrons to move. I mean, you can think of that. And it is these electrons moving, sort of trying to cancel out that field, the process that in a static situation, we have some electrostatic cage and we come up with an electric field, the charges will redistribute until they cancel that electric field out inside. That's certainly true. What we have right now is a situation where they are constantly moving, in a sense, trying to cancel this out, but because we're continually regenerating this field in that region, they sort of just keep moving, and that's what you call a current. So, you can imagine then that the degree to which these things want to move depends on the potential that you put across this conductor. So you might imagine that the current is going to be proportional to the potential. And in fact, it is. You can go and actually measure this. But we define the resistance as the constant of proportionality. And different substances will have a different... So if you were to plot the current versus the potential across this thing, you'll get a line. And if you have a substance that has a higher resistance, it'll be down here. The slope will be lower. If you have a lower resistance, then for a given amount of potential across the thing, you'll get a higher current. That is, it's easier for the electrons, or it's easier for the charge to flow. We need to now move away from saying electrons and stuff. We need to sort of just talk about charge, because you need to be thinking about positive charge moving. So here's your lower resistance. Okay? And this complicated expression is what we know as Ohm's law. And a great many real substances in life actually follow Ohm's law very nicely, at least within a reasonable range of potentials. So most substances, many substances, conductors that you actually put in normal batteries and things, will have a nice linear shape here. but not everything. And things that actually have this linear behavior, you call ohmic. Okay? So they follow Ohm's law. There, if you take the potential and you reverse it, the current's going to go the other way. That's a very simple thing. It will again be proportional to the potential that you put across. Not every substance is completely linear. If you go to extraordinarily high potentials, you might have completely different behavior. So it's over ranges. So in the real life, again, you have to be a bit careful. You have to understand how linear the material is if it is important to whatever it is that you're doing in the lab or you're trying to build. There are also substances where if you put the potential across one direction, you can get nice ohmic behavior of this linear change in current for potential. If you flip it around the other way, you can get nothing going the other way. These kinds of things are called diodes, and they're an important component of many sorts of electrical circuits. So life can be complicated, but we're only going to deal with this in this class, okay? Okay, now it's an exciting moment because we're going to add another circuit element for you. We've got, remember, we've got our EMF, and we hook it across conducting wire. And now what we do, although this wire is a conductor, and in any real conductor or anything that's not a superconductor, it will have resistance. So copper, it has a resistance, all right? But it's a very low resistance. Having said that, when you look at circuit diagrams, you always assume that these wires are resistance-free unless the problem is specifically asking you otherwise. If you are actually building a real circuit, you need to remember that they're not resistance-free. And one of the things you have to keep in mind is, am I going to melt them, right, when I hook them across my power supply? And if you don't burn up a few wires in your time here in some of your labs, I mean, something's wrong. I mean, it's part of the fun is you forget to turn the switch off and all of a sudden, you know, what is that? And you look, make sure it's not you on fire, and then you realize, you know, it's over here, and then you... And in fact, you'll probably see me do it in one of the demos this year. It almost happens every year. At any rate, what you assume in the circuit diagrams, typically, unless the problem is asking you very specifically about the resistance of the wire itself, you assume that all of the resistance is collected in places in the circuit where it specifies. So we need a symbol for resistance, which is some sort of jagged thing like this. And the symbol for a resistor in a circuit is just an R. Resistance, the units of resistance are ohms. Okay, so something that has a lot of resistance has a lot of has many ohms. Something that has a small resistance has few ohms. So now we have our simple circuit, and if you send a current through a resistor, the effect is that the resistor effectively bleeds off energy and transforms it into heat. So it's good to try to quantify that. So we know that the potential that we put across a resistor, right? So we have some potential, I'm really good at this, right? Because now I'm talking about the same thing, and I already have two symbols for it. Okay, so I want you to truly appreciate that. So the potential here. we know is the work per unit charge it takes to go from one side here to the other side. And in a sense, we've been thinking about that very often, as how much work per unit charge does it take to move a piece from here to here. That is the amount of work that's being done by this EMF. That's the amount of chemical work that it does, or mechanical work if it's a generator thing, whatever it is. It is also the amount of work that is done on a charge that moves through this resistor, because it's going from something here to something there that are at different potentials, okay? And remember that this piece is all at one potential, and this is all at one potential because those are conductors. So when we talk about the potential difference in the work per unit charge, you can think about moving across this gap, but it's also this gap, okay? So let us ask, what is the work per unit charge it takes to move some charge through that resistor? And since we have a potential across that, it is that potential difference. Okay, so that's the work per unit charge it takes to go through. So that means that the work goes as Q times the potential. And what I'd like to do, because we're picturing the resistor as a place where as the charge goes through, it hits the different pieces and actually agitates it and loses energy to heat. So what I'd like to do is quantify how much energy that is. So the power lost by the current in the resistor goes as the change in this work with respect to time. And if we have a battery which has a fixed potential, the V here is not going to change with time. So this just becomes dQ over dt times the potential, or I times V. So the power lost in a resistor with a potential difference across it and a given current is going to be IV. We also know that V is equal to IR, because that's basically how we're defining resistance. So we can use that and rewrite these things. We have three variables. So if we want to get rid of the current, for example, that's equal to V over R. So this becomes V squared over R. If we want to get rid of the potential, for example, we know that's equal to IR. So this becomes I squared R. So in a way that's very similar to the capacitance formulas that we've seen, we have different forms for the power loss and a resistance. These are all equivalent. And this is unavoidable if you're using electric stuff and you don't have semiconductors going. This is the primary energy loss in our power grid. If you could make superconducting, that is, what you mean when you say a superconductor is that it's resistance free, so the current can move without actually generating heat. If we could take our power grid and change it to superconductors right now, I forget what the gain is, but it's like a factor of a third or a half of the power would be free. I mean, we right now are generating a lot of heat with this stuff. If you ask what is the limitation for computers, the idea with computers is you're shrinking the circuits and making them smaller and smaller. So that what that does is you're actually shrinking the conducting pieces where the charges are flowing more and more, yet it still has resistance. So you reach the point, if you're running a lot of calculations and stuff, it gets hot and you literally can melt down and burn your thing. So this is a limitation in the power of computation, or at least the power per square millimeter or whatever. So this is a very real issue in life that you're going to have to deal with all the time. If you're designing a house or anything like that, doing an electric circuitry, you need to make sure that you understand that you're not going to cause fires and melt down things, stuff like this. If you want to save a house, for example, if you've ever wondered, at least in the old days, fuses are made up of, they're in a circuit of the house, and they literally have a little piece in them that is more prone to burn due to resistive heating than other stuff. So that if you make the mistake of dropping the hairdryer in the bathtub or something like that, it will begin to draw a lot of current because there's now a nice sink for the current to go into, and it will just... it's not a good thing. And as that current flows, it's going to increase the resistive heating in the fuse, and it'll actually melt it and break the connection. So that's the idea behind the fuses that look like little cylinders. And if you look carefully in them, very often they're glass, and you can see a little wire in there. And that little wire is what burns when the fuse goes. So, anyway, this is good stuff. Any questions about all that? Yes. It's not at all unusual to be just, if you're in a lab, having to go find kilo-ohm, mega-ohm resistors. So an ohm is a small number in everyday sort of circuits. Kilo-ohms and that type of thing is probably something you deal with more. Oops. Back to that. Okay, so of course we can. Let's do something though. Why don't we see if we can fire this baby up? Turn on your things, see if it sees you. All right, well, we'll just see if it answers. So, okay. Like to do here is to imagine that we have a very powerful source of potential power supply, and we hook it across very thick conductors here and here, and then across these conductors we put two nails that are equal in terms of material and cross section, one of which is shorter than the other. And what I would like you to think about is which of these will melt first. Okay, so think about that for a minute. Don't talk about it yet, but then we're going to see what we think. I'm sorry?
What is in the middle?
A nail. Two identical nails, one of which, they're basically fastened here and here, but you're across a shorter section of the nail here than you are here. Like real nails. Okay. I haven't started this yet. I'm just letting you think for a second. I'll start it now.
But you should still be able to join the class.
I don't think it is, but let me try. Yeah, so where?
Because you named it, but the name you entered isn't joining. There's a class showing up.
No, you just started the question.
Yeah, no, I did. I was wanting to see. Just press some things. Let's see if it shows. Okay. Yeah, so last year, if I did it this way, it was fine and people could join. I don't understand. I don't know what's changed in this year. Well, the software changed. I don't know what underneath it changed. I don't know how to fix this. All right, so we're going to have to do the voting because I'm not going to debug this now. I just have to. It's changed its behavior. Yeah. Pain in the butt. Okay, whatever. I don't care. All right. So, close your eyes. Well, figure out which one you think. All right, then close your eyes. How many of you think one, which would be the short one, will go first? How many of you think two, which is the long one, will go first? And how many of you think they'll melt at the same time? Okay, so I would say we have somewhat of an even distribution with probably fewer choosing one than chose two and three, slightly more choosing two than chose three. Okay. I didn't give you four as an option.
But.
Okay. All right, so what I have here, amazingly enough, is just what I said up there. Here we have two identical nails. Here the distance between these two big conductors is fairly small. Okay? Here it's much longer. Okay? All right. Now this is basically hooked directly across the wall, so you ready? Which one went first? All right. Why? The short one has less resistance. That's true. Same potential across it, so it has more current by a factor of two, right? Because it's proportional to the resistance. Well, by a factor of a pretty good factor, actually. I'm sorry, this one isn't just a factor of two shorter, but you say a factor of four. So you have more current. But the resistance is less. The power goes as I squared R. The resistance piece is less linearly by this distance. But the current is more by that same factor, and it goes as I squared. So the current's going to win. So the fact that you have more current going through the short one means you'll have more power. More power means more heat generation, and it's going to melt. You all right with that? Okay. I've got lots of nails up here. All right. Probably have another one. Okay, so we've got power company is coming to you. They want you to design something for them. And you've got these lines going, which eventually go to your to the outlet. Which of these designs would be best? You have just a wire as this conductor. You have a wire with a conducting sheath around it. This is a symbol that means set to ground, which basically defines this as a potential of zero. Or you have a wire with a conductor, non-conducting, like a rubbery plastic around it. Okay? And so if you were CEO of this power company, which of these designs would you prefer?
Does the conducting sheath touch the wire?
Nope, there's nothing touching there. You can think of maybe this as being filled with a non-conductor or something so that it doesn't touch.
Are the wires necessarily above ground?
Sure. All right, close your eyes. All who say A, which is the bare conductor. All who say B, which is the conducting sheathed conductor. And all who say C, which is the rubberized conductor. Okay. So I think there were a couple of hands that went up for A. There were almost an equal split amongst the rest of you between B and C. So what are the issues that you might consider? Energy dissipation, heat loss, okay. What other issues might be important?
Electric interference with the...
Electric interference, what was it you were saying?
An electric field pushing the electrons back.
Electric field pushing the electrons back, okay. Okay, a couple of other things pop in my head. I'd be really worried with this one. Because you're gonna kill a lot of kids that way.
Right.
Ah, okay. Safety aside, yes. Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. There's another big issue.
Weather
would be a big factor. Yeah, yeah. What else?
The stealing
of electricity. I have a feeling the design of the wires is probably pretty good in Baghdad, but they have found ways to steal the electricity anyway. So someone who wants to steal it will manage to figure out how to connect to the right wire, no matter how you have this set up, I imagine. How much energy does it take? Which one is going to power up with the least energy?
B.
Because the electric field in B is completely confined in this little region. That electric field inside this little region is the same as it is here and here, except here and here it extends to infinity. So you're going to have a lot more energy stored up in this one and that one. I mean, some of these other issues, I think, are things you would consider. And actually, this is the winner in most of those ways too, because if you have this sheath, then you also have defined that as zero potential, so people who handle that are not going to necessarily get shocked. But it's also much more expensive. I mean, this is a coaxial cable, so I mean, I'm not even saying that they do that. But ideally, if you could afford the cable and everything, you'd probably play that game. In real life, I'm not actually sure they do. With their big high-tension power lines, they may not actually do this kind of thing. But, okay. Yeah. Well, you know, even if I saw the sheath there, I would want to make sure that if I ended up breaking through that sheath, that I didn't become instant toast. So, when I was in graduate school, I was working at Nevis Labs, which is a high energy physics laboratory in Dobbs Ferry in Westchester County that Columbia has. And one day we were sitting there working, and there was this loud bang, and the lights went out and everything. So we figured a transformer blew or whatever. And so we walked out to the transformer station, and we could see some smoke and flames and everything. And then we could see the front half of a squirrel on the transformer, and the back half of the squirrel sort of hanging on some wire over here. Smoking. It was one of those sweet and sour sort of moments. It wasn't really funny, but we couldn't help ourselves. So be careful where you step. All right. So let us imagine that we have resistors in a circuit in a situation where they are in parallel. So I'll call this R1 and R2. And if you haven't noticed, there's nothing religious about whether the R is uppercase or lowercase with resistors. And what I'd like to do is to put a potential across this system of resistors. And you can now imagine that these resistances you could put in a box. Where you didn't realize you had the two in there. And if we do that, we'll say that we have a resistance R, which would basically be the total resistance of this little two resistor package. And if we have a potential across this R, we know that we will have a current. And this current, when it reaches this point, has a choice as to which direction it goes. So the current will actually split as it goes here. So you'll have some go through here and some go through here. So in the general case, we'll say that we have I2 going through the lower resistor and I1 going through the upper resistor. Okay? All right. Now, this potential across this whole circuit is the same as the potential across R1 and the potential across R2. So we know that V is equal to I1 times R1, V is equal to I2 times R2, and V is equal to I times big R, right? And we know that I is equal to I1 plus I2, because current you can think of like water flow in pipes. It's conserved. Okay, if I shove a bunch of current on one side of a wire, it's going to come out the other side of the wire. All right. So, if I is equal to I1 plus I2, then I know that I is equal to big V over R. I1 is equal to big V over R1, and I2 is equal to big V over R2. So this tells us that 1 over R is equal to 1 over R1 plus 1 over R2. Or 1 over total R is equal to the sum of the reciprocal of the little resistances over all of the resistors that are in parallel. So this is what you get for resistors in parallel. Oops. We could also have resistors in series. And put a potential across those. And if we have the potential across those, we'll have a current going through them. Again, you can imagine having a shoebox around these three things so that you don't even know that there are three resistors there. And we'll say that from the point of view of the shoebox resistor, you just have a big resistance R. In this case, we have a potential that we know, V, but it's across all three of these things. So we know what this current is. That's also the same current that goes through all three resistors, because it has to. They're all hooked up in series. So the one end of the pipe is here, the other end of the pipe is here, and if I shove water through here, it has to come out over there, which means these charges have to slug their way through each of these resistors, and they're going to lose some energy across all three. So in terms of work or energy, the work per unit charge it takes to go from the left-hand side here to the right-hand side there, I know it's this big V, but that has to be the sum of the work per unit charge it takes to go through here, here, and here, because those are the only places you actually have to do work, because the rest of this is, the wire is just conductors and you're not doing any work there. So I know that V is equal to IR. V is also equal to V1 plus V2 plus V3, so that would be the potential drop across resistor 1, the potential drop across potential 2, resistor 2, and the potential drop across resistor 3. Or to think about that, V1 is the amount of work per unit charge it takes for the charge to go through resistor 1. V2 is the amount of work per unit charge it takes to go through resistor 2, etc. So V is equal to I times big R on the left-hand side. V1 is equal to I. It's the same I through all the resistors, so I don't have to specify which I, but it's through resistance 1. V2 is I times R2. V3 is I times R3. So this tells us that big R is equal to R1 plus R2 plus R3. Or for resistors in series, we know that R is equal to the sum over all the resistors that are in series. So that's the formula we use. Okay? So just one more heads up. When we did capacitors, for capacitors in parallel, they added linearly like this. This is resistors in series. For capacitors in series, we got the reciprocal. 1 over C is the sum of 1 over the little C's. So you have sort of the same form, but it's reversed for resistors and capacitors, so keep that in mind. The one that I use, if I'm having to actually remember it, is this one. Because if you think about how much charge it takes to shove it through here, this total resistance is going to be, the total resistance here is going to be equal to the resistance that you have to go through, the sum of them. So somehow to me, of all those of those four formulas, the one that makes intuitive sense to me and that I always come back to is just this one. And once you get one of them, you know that if resistors in series have this form, then I know that resistors in parallel are reciprocal, and capacitors are the other way around. So that way I always can get all four formulas. So you have to do it however works for you, but that's how it works for me. Any questions? Okay, so let us imagine that we have a circuit where we have an EMF and a little resistance. And a big resistance, and we come back. Generally speaking, from most of the problems you do, all of the resistance you can be thought of as in some sort of external resistor that's in the circuit somewhere, okay? Having said that, sometimes you will run into the fact that your EMF itself, be it a battery or a generator, is also made up of actual stuff. So any real EMF is going to have something which is called an internal resistance. So you have to keep that in mind. Most problems, you just don't have to worry about it. You can think of the EMF as being resistance-free, and if there's resistance in the problem, they'll tell you about it, okay? Having said that, if they talk about the internal resistance for the battery, what you want to do is to think of it like this. Here's your battery. There is a little bit of resistance inside that battery, okay? So the terminal voltage on the battery actually will now depend on the current that the battery is got, right? If I'm not pulling any current from this battery, then the potential difference between this point and that point is going to be this EMF. If I'm pulling current, then I have a current going through here. It's going to actually take some energy for that current to fight its way through this little resistance. And the potential here to here is going to drop by whatever that current value is times this resistance a little bit. So you'll actually get a terminal voltage across this battery or this EMF that's a little bit reduced from what the thing is labeled to have. So that's the idea of an internal resistance. And generally speaking, when you're doing problems or whatever, there will be something in the problem that will basically give you a clue that you need to be worrying about the internal resistance or not. They'll talk about it in some form or another. Your default frame of mind should be not to worry about it because you don't see it that often, but be aware of it. I'm sure there'll be a couple of problems with it and everything that you have to deal with. At any rate, I threw it in here just so we consider it. And what I'd like to do is to consider a point A here and a point B up here. And I would like to look at the potential of this circuit as you go from one side to the other. Actually, let me So when I plot is on the y-axis, the potential, and remember that's a measure of the energy, basically, okay? The potential energy of a charge would be the potential times the charge at the given point. And on the x-axis, I want to look at the location that you are on the circuit. So I'm going to take the circuit and we're going to start at point A and then we're going to begin to move through the circuit. So the circuit's going to, we're going to get to the point where we get to the EMF, which is going to look like so. Then we're going to go through the little resistor, R. Then we're going to hit point B. And then we come around through big R and then we're back to point A. And the potential difference between point A and point A is got to be zero. So that means whatever the potential is that I have here, I have to come back to it here. All right? And we'll just define that to be zero at the moment. So we're going to say at point A, I have a potential of zero. So I'm down here. And then I get to the EMF. What does the EMF do? The EMF actually, as you go across it, gives you a potential which is equal to the size of the EMF. So that means all of a sudden we jump And the level that we jump to is the value of the EMF. So the potential in the circuit at that point is up at the EMF, and you maintain that until you hit the little resistor. As you go across the resistor, the potential drop depends on the current. If there's no current, there's no potential drop. If there is a current, then you have a potential drop across there because V is equal to IR. So that means when you hit the little resistor, you drop a bit. This distance that you drop is equal to the current in the circuit times the little resistor. So we're going to have a current in this circuit, little I. Then you're in a conductor, so you have no change in potential until you actually hit the resistance itself, the big R. And then, again, it takes a lot of energy to put the charge through that big resistance, so we fall back down to zero here. And this difference is I times big R. And then we come back to where we started. You okay with that? Yes?
So the current adjusts itself so that from A to all the way back to when you're at A, it's going to be zero. Because obviously if it's smaller I, then you're going all around, the potential of the next day would be higher. So that the current goes through.
Yeah, the potential at A has to be the same as at A, and the amount of current you get is basically the amount of current that allows that to happen. So it's sort of a chicken and egg thing, you know. The amount of current is dictated by how much resistance you have in there, which in turn makes this sort of happen. So I'm not quite sure how to look at it, but yeah, it all fits together. It all has to fit together. If you take any point in this circuit and you do a sum of voltage drops across the elements in the circuit all the way back to that point, the sum has to be zero. Okay? All right. So, let's suppose that you are walking in an alley and you meet a mean circuit, okay? And the electrons are not looking for love. What do you do? How do you solve such a thing? You know, hopefully, and I wish this for you, you have engineers for that. You say, I need to do this. Can you make me a circuit that does that or something? But they'll come back to you with lots of questions and stuff. So there is some possibility that won't happen. So we have to look at how to solve this. The other thing is, it's always good to know what your engineers are actually thinking when they're solving stuff. So it's good to look at the basic principles that they're using in whatever computer program or calculation they're using to solve your electric circuit. So let us suppose we have some arbitrarily nasty circuit. How do we actually figure out what the current is going to do and everything? So there are a couple of basic principles that we're going to use, and these rules and some conventions that we're going to use to solve these things. So the first rule is, these are called Kirchhoff's rules. The first rule is that if I start at some place in this loop and I go around this loop, or go around the circuit in a loop of some form and come back to the same point, the sum of all of the voltage changes has to be zero. So that's just what we did with this one little problem. So here could be one loop, for example. Here could be a loop. Here could be a loop. Here could be a loop. Around here is a loop. It doesn't really matter. if you go from one point and you go around circuit elements and back to that point, the sum of the voltages is zero. So that's what it says. The other thing is that at any branch point in the circuit, say right here, if I have a certain current coming in here to that branch point, it's got to be equal to the amount of current that's leaving. So current is conserved at any branch point in the circuit. All right? And you may not know what the direction is. It could be that I have current coming in here and current coming in here, and those are equal to the current going out there. All you really know is that the sum of the currents at any given branch point in the circuit is zero. So those are the two basic principles that you can use to solve this sort of thing. So what you do is you take whatever the circuit is and you look at how many topologically independent loops you can put in this system. All right. So here, for example, here would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 I could do. But if I did those 6 and then I did this one, that's not independent, because those 6 together would have all the information that I would have here, because all of the elements of the circuit were in some other loop that I've already considered. So what you do is, whatever the configuration is, you choose topological loops that are independent, however many independent ones you have. Then you can use this in each of those loops, and if you had n independent loops, you get n independent equations from doing this voltage sum. Then you also have to look at every independent branch point. So you'll have currents going through each of these different branches, and you can do the sum of the currents at each of those points. Also gives you an independent equation. So what happens is, given the topology of the circuit, you can choose independent loops and the independent branch points, and from that you can get n equations, and that means you can then solve for n unknowns within that circuit. If I hand you a circuit and I don't give you anything, then you can't actually solve it, right? But if I give you a circuit and I give you a certain number of unknowns, and you're constrained with some of the things, so long as the number of unknowns is equal to the number of equations that you can get out using this game, then you can actually solve the problem. Exactly. Okay? Sounds like the hordes are at the door, so I'm going to have to quit. And I'll see you this afternoon if you can make it to that. They're new because the whole system was screwed up when I started. So I got new batteries. You're good with that.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
I've put the clip-on gain up high.
Oh, I see. You've adjusted the individual ones.
Yeah, this was muted on this setting, but not on this setting, so it wasn't working at all. So I had a real problem with that.
I have class today doing the question and answer. Is there any way you can put up the notes from the Q&A session?
It doesn't work that way, because I just basically am answering questions. I mean, you can send a friend with questions that you've got and send them that way. You can try asking me or a TA at a different time. I mean, I have to choose a time, and so. Yeah, I figured there's nothing I can do. I'm always going to catch somebody who can't. So. Sorry, yeah.